Hello, everyone. This is Barbara M. Hodges, and you're listening to Red River Radio's No Limits. I'm very happy to have as my guest today Lisa Reagan and Mara Pearl. Now, Mara and I have known each other for a while, but Lisa is new to me, so I'm really looking forward to getting to know more about Lisa. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you for having me.
We're delighted to be here.
Okay. Lisa, let me just... Let's start with you, and would you please tell everyone listening a little bit about yourself?
Well, I write crime fiction, mostly thriller suspense novels, and I live in Philadelphia with my husband and daughter and my Boston Terrier named Mr. Philip. And the series that I've been working on for the last 2 years is the Detective Josie Quinn series. And it's about a detective who works in a small city in central Pennsylvania. It's a fictional city.
Okay, and Mara, how about a little bit about yourself?
Yes, so I write a series that I've been working on for many, many years. It's called the Milford Haven novels and novellas, set in the Central Coast. This series began as a radio drama that was on the air in the Central Coast to begin with, and then was discovered by the BBC and became a hit in the UK with 4.5 million listeners. And that sparked interest in creating books based on the radio drama. So, and now the books have become a larger universe than the original radio drama was.
Okay, thank you. So, Lisa and Mara, same question for you also. What do you wish someone would have told you before you started to write fiction? Lisa, I'll start with you.
What do I wish someone had told me? Probably that that writing books is the easy part. And selling books is the more difficult part. I believe that for me, when I was an aspiring writer, the writing seemed like the hardest part. But once you get past the hurdle of publication, often moving copies is really the more challenging thing. And I've been really lucky with the publisher I have now that publishes the Josie Quinn series, that every book has hit the USA Today and Wall Street Journal bestseller list. But for many years before that, it was quite a struggle.
Okay, Mara, same question. What do you wish someone would have told you before you started writing fiction?
Well, I certainly concur with what Lisa said. But on the other hand, I'm kind of glad I didn't know, because with the sense of vision and hope and determination that I had going into it, I wasn't dealing with the obstacles of a lot of negativity about it's going to be hard. And so it's been an interesting ride. Publishing has shifted so much during the past, let's say 20 years that I've been involved with it. And traditional publishing in some regards has ended, and then self-publishing arose. What interests me the most, I think, in the publishing industry now is independent publishing, which is a hybrid where you really are working with wonderful professionals, but you have more say as an author. And since I'm the one who knows my series best, I appreciate the fact that I have a lot of input in cover design, branding, connecting with my audience.
Okay, thank you, Mara. Next question for you also, Mara. What do you feel is the best thing about writing?
At the deepest level, I think writing for me and many of my author colleagues is a chance to examine the issues that matter to us the most. It's kind of a chance to unwind our snarls. We go along in life until we reach something that's a tangle, and we either untangle it right then, or if we cannot, then we have to sort of skip over it. But sooner or later, we have to come back to it. And I find I'm working on issues like that with my characters. Some are issues that I have dealt with myself. Some are issues that interest me that I've observed other people dealing with. And I like to say that nonfiction is about facts, but fiction is about truth. It's this powerful lens through which we can examine, I think, some of the deepest issues of life. Even in lighthearted escapist fiction, there's still a sense of imagine such and such, imagine this, what would you do if? And it gives you a chance to think those things through.
Okay, thank you. And Lisa, the same question. What is, as far as you're concerned, the best thing about writing fiction?
Well, I just want to say that I absolutely love what Maura said about untangling snarls and that fiction is truth. I think that is such a wonderful benefit for fiction writers. And I know that when I was a child and then a teenager and I started writing, it was always to make sense of my world. So I really think Maura hit that on the head there. For me, the things that I enjoy most is just the act of creating. And right up there with that would be the connection that I get to make with readers. I especially love when, you know, I've written a book and it's been published, and then I start getting messages from readers who say to me, you know, I've been having a really hard time in life, or I lost a loved one, or I'm disabled, or I'm just having depression and anxiety, or whatever they're going through. And then they say to me, but your book gave me some sweet relief from those harsh realities. So for a few hours or a day, I was able to be transported out of these terrible things that are going on in my life, thanks to what you wrote. And to me, there is nothing more rewarding than that. So that has become my favorite part about writing.
Okay, thank you. So also, Lisa, while I'm speaking with you, let's turn it around. What is it that you don't like about writing?
Revisions. Absolutely, 100% revisions. I have a love-hate relationship because I hate doing them, but I am always so much more satisfied with the way that the book turns out after I've done them. But getting in there and really pulling the book apart and putting it back together and putting in new things and taking out things that maybe I love but just don't work can be a very painful process.
Okay, Maura.
Amen. I totally agree with what Lisa said. You know, darn it, my editor is always right. You know, and she's so brilliant. I tell her that she has a third eye that's capable of seeing what I meant to write. And she knows perfectly well when I have managed to do it and when I have not. And although it's so, you know, the emotions that arise when you really think you've finished a chapter and you get this kind of feedback, it goes all the way from disappointment with yourself and frustration and anger at the editor and a feeling that you're never going to be really a wonderful writer after all, which you thought you were at one point. And then it eventually swings to a great sense of gratitude. Thank you so much for helping me to see that, because that really was the point. And if I see it that clearly, so will my reader. And then just to Lisa's earlier point about the connection with readers is so precious. You know, as writers, we spend all this time alone. We're with our own thoughts. And there comes a time when it's very helpful to really hear from readers what something has meant to them, whether it's through an email or a note or it's a comment in person. It's really is helpful and encouraging. It's like, okay, that made a difference to someone. That means I really am on the right track and I should keep going.
Okay, thank you. So let's talk a little bit about how the two of you write. Now, Lisa, do you outline, or are you a feet of the pants writer? What works for you?
I used to be by the seat of my pants type of writer, but over the years I've changed over to the outline because it just, for me, doing it by the seat of my pants was just so inefficient because at the end then I would have so much work to do. Now I find that if I outline a really detailed outline, like between 15 and 20 pages, that if I do that, I can work out most of the kinks in the outline, and it just, the whole process is a lot faster and there's a lot less work during the editing process.
Okay, Mar, what about you?
Pretty much the same. Now, I came into fiction sort of backwards, meaning in most instances, someone writes a book and then it gets converted into a script and becomes a television show or a film. I went the other way since I had written scripts first and then was translating that into novels. So you could say I had an extensive outline, pardon me, to begin with. However, the novels have much more depth and detail than can possibly be fit into a half-hour drama. So the outline goes through several stages. I have a document that's broad strokes, kind of little boxes of this has to happen in this scene and then this and then this. Then I extend and expand each of those boxes. And then eventually I have an actual document where there's some flow from chapter to chapter. And if while I'm writing that outline, the dialogue itself starts to come to me or a descriptive passage starts to come to me, I certainly let it flow. I don't chop that off. I will say there is some seat of the pants writing that still happens in that, you know, I may be waiting in line at a bank or I may be driving somewhere or sitting in a cafe and a scene or a chapter or a moment may come to me and I don't quite know where it's going to fit. But I am obedient to the muse so that the moment those ideas are coming through, I really make an effort to capture them. I do not assume that it will come again.
Okay, thank you. Now, Mara, you have said that your writing is women's fiction. Would you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yes, it was an interesting journey. The drama was, I thought, for general audiences. On the other hand, it was a soap opera, and the primary audience for soaps is women, certainly not exclusively. But I found myself in the journey of discovering how books work and the fact that our world is much more focused on genre than it ever used to be. And so I began to drill down and really think more closely about women's fiction and did it exist and what was it? And I was going to be speaking at the Ventura Book Festival several years ago, and a wonderful author named Andrew Clavin was going to be speaking. And I called Andrew and said, would you like to have a debate about men's fiction versus women's fiction? And he said, Mara, there's no such thing as men's fiction. And I said, well, I'm sorry, there is, if there's women's fiction. And so he said, well, okay. So we had this fabulous debate. And it's not like it's two buckets. It's rather there's a continuum. And he and I began to identify what were some of the markers that you might say for men's fiction would be velocity. And for women's fiction, you might say more detail. So let's say it's a restaurant scene. So if it's men's fiction, the guy comes into the restaurant, looks around, assesses everybody, sits where his back is not to the front door, and then the scene begins. If it's women's fiction and a female character comes into the restaurant, she notices what color the tablecloths are, what kind of flowers are on the table, what the waitresses are wearing, are their skirts too short, what kind of music is playing, what are the aromas that are coming from the kitchen. And yes, it slows down the narrative, but on the other hand, for female readers, generally that information is encoded. So if I write about a woman who's dressed in a silk suit with a French twist and high heels, my readers, I don't have to explain to them that that character has a certain income, is a professional woman, and lives in the city. They already got all that from what's embedded in my description of what she's wearing. So there really is a difference in how people read. Now, the other thing I would say, it's not just men who read men's fiction, and it's not just women who read women's fiction. Everybody gets in the mood for a real page-turner. I remember when my husband and I were both reading Dan Brown and really, you know, enjoying that. But generally, my husband will say, if he's reading something in women's fiction or one of my books, he'll say, well, why do I have to know all that? And now he understands that sort of coding that I'm talking about.
So, Mara, it sounds like that a lot of times in your writing, when you're doing the description, that you're almost writing a subtext.
Well, and that's a whole topic, isn't it? I'm sure Lisa would agree. We could certainly talk about text and subtext for days. I mean, it's what a rich, wonderful topic. Absolutely. Any good fiction is filled with subtext. So, yes.
Okay. So then, Lisa, can crime fiction be women's fiction?
I think it depends. There's a lot of kind of different subgenres now, like the psychological thriller and the thrillers that deal with domestic situations. So I just read Gillian McMillan's The Nanny a few weeks ago, and that, to me, it was gripping and wonderful, but the domestic side of it, I felt like, you know, the male readers I know wouldn't be as interested in that as they would be in your very, you know, typical high-stakes suspense thriller, where, like Mara said, it's about velocity. It's about, you know, the movement of the plot and everything serving the plot and things happening, and less of the description and less of the internal monologues. So I think it depends on the book.
And the other thing I think about mystery.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say, in mystery, any and everything can be a clue. So there's
right.
a bit more of an excuse or a reason to have detail in mystery. And so it's tricky. I think it takes a lot of mastery to dial in a mystery to your specific genre.
I agree with that.
Okay. Thank you. Let's talk a little bit about characters. First of all, let me ask you, Mara, would you say your books are more character-driven or plot-driven?
They're more character-driven. And again, I could go off on a full-day seminar on that subject.
Yeah.
For me, the characters, the plot comes from the characters. If you know the characters well enough and you know where they're trying to go, what their goals are, what their obstacles are, then the plot will tend to write itself, if that makes sense. I don't really love either writing or even reading where I can see the seams too easily, where I can see, okay, the person decided this is the plot and they're going to make those characters work that way, whether they really want to or not. I have the opposite experience. I have the experience where sometimes my characters actually surprise me. And, you know, people who don't write fiction sometimes think that those of us who do are quite crazy, because how can my characters possibly surprise me? But they do, because I'm interested in revelation. I'm interested in listening, as it were, listening to these characters and getting deep enough to understand, oh, here's something I didn't realize that would, of course, be true about Samantha. She wouldn't drive that car. She wouldn't agree with that argument, even though logically within her job it would make sense. There's something else that's driving her that's even deeper. And those are the discoveries that access those detanglings that we were talking about earlier that make it so fascinating and worthwhile.
Okay, thank you. Same question, Lisa. Would you consider the Josie Quinn novels to be character-driven or plot-driven?
For me, they're really plot-driven, just in the sense that I know that what my readers want is a good mystery, a good adventure that's, you know, going to carry them through from the first page to the last and keep them turning pages. So my challenge is always choosing a plot or a storyline or a mystery that will resonate in some way with Josie personally. And just like Mara was saying, your characters will surprise you, because I keep finding that the stories or the cases that really get under Josie's skin are the ones that revolve around this theme of motherhood. What is a good mother? What's not a good mother? You know, what is the attachment instant, or does it come over time? All of these things are things that she wrestles with, and I find that a lot of the cases that, you know, I write about for her touch on that personally for her. So, you know, when I'm thinking of ideas for the plot, I don't want to do a mystery or a story that is just going to be her phoning it in. I want to do one that's really going to touch her at her core and make her even more motivated to solve the crime. So my challenge always is finding a plot that's going to do that, that's going to work in tandem with her. But it's always, for me, is always the idea or the case first, and moving through that, and then just weaving Josie's personal connection or her personal feelings into that.
That sounds,
you know,
so
I'm
great, Lisa. Yeah.
Lisa, I am so surprised to hear you say that plot-driven, because Josie is one of the most complex characters that I have ever read. I mean, she is one of the most complex characters I have ever read. So I was really surprised to hear you say that it was plot-driven rather than character-driven, because as far as I'm concerned, Josie drives that plot.
Oh, well, that's good.
I mean, Josie drives that plot. Since we're talking about these characters, and I'll go ahead and talk to you, Lisa. How did you go about creating a character like Josie Quinn?
Well, when I was talking to my editor when we were starting the series out, we wanted a character who would kind of not be satisfied with just stepping back. So in the first novel, she's on, you know, paid suspension, and she just can't stand it. She can't stand being out of the loop. She's just not built that way. You know, that's why she's a good detective, is because those questions of what happened and why and when, where, and how, all of those things, all the elements that go into solving a crime, they will keep her up at night. So we wanted someone like that, but we also wanted a character who is a little bit damaged and flawed. And I understand that a lot of people say, you know, that's just a trope and it's overdone. But honestly, I've never read a good thriller or a good mystery where the main character was completely and perfectly well-adjusted and had never had any trauma in their life ever at all. So it was just a matter of, What kind of path is she going to have? So I wanted her to be someone who, she has this really great quality of wanting to bring justice to people and wanting to solve crimes and put the bad guys away, but she also struggles internally with being, in her mind, in her heart, with being a good person. So for me, the best way to do that was to go back into the childhood and kind of set up a situation where she's always fighting against the notion that there's something fundamentally wrong with her or fundamentally unlovable about her just because of the things that happened to her as a child.
I know, she is quite a character. Now, Mara, Samantha is another one that's a very complex character. Tell me a little bit how Samantha came to be.
I will be happy to. I was going to talk first about Miranda, who is my protagonist. And she is an artist And I think what interested me was a series of dichotomies, the interior life versus the exterior life, and the logical basis for decisions and the intuitive basis for decisions. Some of this I didn't understand until later. I didn't see my own larger themes until I had been working at it for a while. But Miranda, as the story begins, is living in the city, but she's a painter of wildlife and landscape. And she doesn't see the inherent dissonance between those two factors in her life until she does. And then, although she's starting to make it and she's in a good gallery and she's, you know, now by now making a living, she realizes that there's some essential discomfort with this and perhaps some essential inauthenticity. So her journey begins, the heroine's journey begins with kind of really upsetting the apple cart and leaving behind all that comfort and familiarity, finding a completely new place to live, and then she moves to the Central Coast and finds this little town. Well, everyone she knows is against this move. Her parents think she's lost her mind. Her sister thinks that she's being irresponsible financially. Her representative threatens to drop her. But there is this internal imperative to follow what her intuition is telling her rather than just sticking with the logical life plan. So it's really interesting. It begins to work for her, but she is discovering a new way of thinking, a new way of trusting the intuitive side of herself and folding it in to the other information that's guiding her life.
Okay, now talk to us a little bit about Samantha. For some reason,
okay,
I don't know, I just like Samantha.
Yeah, I do too. Well, Samantha has a lot of resonances and similarities to Miranda, but she's 20 years older. She's in a different chapter of her life. She's an environmentalist. At the time that I was first writing the radio drama, I wrote her as the head of the Environmental Planning Commission, and at that point, there was no such thing. Now, of course, it's become a much more topical issue. So she's made some decisions in her life. She left a husband. She gave up a child for adoption. And she's this high-powered PhD who kind of single-handedly is saving the planet until these issues begin to catch up with her. And now she's rethinking both of those decisions, has decided to see if she can try to find the son that she gave up. And in a soap opera-ish plot twist, her ex-husband is now also in the small town where they are living. And they are constantly on opposite sides of the fence, politically and professionally. So they're constantly arguing. And is it because of their personal connection? Yes. And is it because of their professional antipathy? Yes. And she's a journal keeper, and so she's really a thinker. And in the journal entries that conclude each novel, I have fun really kind of letting it rip with her musings about what's going on within herself and what's going on in the world at large.
Okay, thank you. See why I like Samantha? I think Samantha is I like them both, but for some reason, Samantha just really jumped out at me. I guess it's just that what happens. Okay, ladies, we hear a lot about writing style. So, Lisa, I'm going to put you on the spot. What is your writing style?
My writing style, I would say fast-paced and cinematic. That's what the readers always tell me.
Okay, and then Mara, what's your writing style?
I have also been told my writing is cinematic or visual. I think the first novelist that really began writing the interior dialogue was Jane Austen. And I admire and am fascinated by identifying thought processes. It's done now by all of us. So it's commonplace, but it's not easy to accurately identify the difference between how we are presenting ourselves in any given setting and what we are really thinking. So I don't know that it's properly a style, but that interior dialogue is a big component, and then being very visual so that all the senses are being stimulated. You know, not only what it looks like in the room where you find yourself in the, you know, given chapter, but also how it feels, what the temperature is, how it smells, how it sounds.
Okay. So, Lisa, how do you balance your real life with your author life?
It's a little bit of a circus. I only quit my day job back in May, so it's a lot easier now. But before that, you know, I would be working full time as a paralegal, raising my daughter, and you know, husband, you want to pay attention to your spouse so they don't leave, and somehow still try to work in all of this writing. So what I have learned to do is write in the chaos. So I don't actually have a quiet office or any place that I go to write, mostly because if I was in there, they would come in anyway. So I have a little spot on the couch in the living room, and my family can kind of tell by the look on my face that I'm in the book. So if I'm typing away on my laptop, you know, they'll know, let's wait till that look goes away, and then we'll ask Mom a question. So I just was always writing whenever I had time. And so if I was standing in line at the post office, which is in my neighborhood, is good for an hour or two, or waiting in doctor's waiting rooms, also good for an hour or two, I would have a little notebook that I would take out, and I would just start writing away. Or if my husband wanted, you know, to swing by Home Depot, I would say, well, you go in, and I'll sit out here with my notebook. And so that was kind of how I got most of my writing done. And now it's a little bit easier. I just write during the day, and then when I pick up my daughter from school, you know, I can have more time with her. And then now my husband and I can actually do things together and watch television together and that sort of thing. So it's become a lot easier. But it's very difficult, I think, because a lot of times if I'm really deep into the story, I don't want to stop. And even after I've closed the laptop and, you know, we're sitting down to dinner or I'm helping my daughter with my homework, my brain is still going. So I just have to kind of let that percolate in the back of my mind for the next time that I sit down to the computer. And I don't really need the notebooks anymore now. I just use my laptop.
And Lisa, somewhere in all of that, you have Mr. Phillip.
I do. He is my writing partner. He's always next to me, sleeping or whining or staring at me until it's time for me to be finished.
Okay. So, Mara, the same question. I know that you're a performer among everything else you do. So how in the world do you balance all of that with your author life?
It is indeed a juggling act. I can certainly relate to what Lisa was saying. For me, I was single for a very long time, and I have, you know, very entrenched habits of writing for hours at a time, kind of sequestered in whatever space I can manage to carve out. I now have a wonderful office, and we live in two locations, in California and in Colorado, and I have an office in each place where I spend, you know, a great deal of my time. My husband had a very busy career of his own for the first 20 years that we were married. And so I tried my best to adjust my schedule to his. He was a physician, so sometimes he was on call. But, you know, I did really have a lot of time to work. He is now retired, and as you know, we writers never retire. So he, it was pretty funny the first few weeks. He'd come into my office, you know, like 8 times in a row. And I was like, may I help you? and it just didn't occur to him that I was actually working. You know, he had never really seen me do that since he'd been busy in his own profession. So until I got a very nice little sign and put it on my door and closed it to say, you know, novel in progress. As for the performing, that's always been a sort of balancing act for me, and it has been really great for me. It was a struggle when I was much younger because well-meaning people would say, you know, you really, your writing is taking off. You really ought to give up that acting stuff. Or the opposite. They'd say, well, now you've got this fantastic part. You really ought to stop that writing stuff. Well, I was waiting for my car after an audition one day in L.A., and Alan Alda was waiting for his car. And I couldn't really pretend I didn't know who he was. So I said, Mr. Alda, I'm a fan. And he said, gee, shucks. And I said, but I have a question for you. And he just came alive. And he said, yes. I said, how do you manage to be a writer and a producer and a director and, a, you know, all these different things? And he said, you know, I did all that directing and acting so that I could figure out how to write. And as he drove away, I thought, oh, yep, I think he solved my life for me. In other words, for me, these talents are synergistic, not in competition with one another. The writing makes me a better performer. The performing makes me a better writer. So I'm delighted. Now, I was doing a lot of television work, theater work, and I do quite a bit less now, but sometimes something very special comes up, as it did last year with portraying Julia Morgan, for example. And I accepted the jobs, even though it impacted my writing schedule. I felt that it was an opportunity not to be missed, and one that would ultimately make me a better writer.
Wow, thank you. Okay, now Lisa mentioned earlier that one of the things that she disliked about being an author was the marketing. We've all been there. So let me ask you, what are today's readers looking for?
I find that what I hear most of the time is they want, and I can only speak to my own genre, that's what I read primarily in, and that's what I discuss with other bloggers and readers and writers the most. I can only speak to that, but they are looking for something that is fast-paced with things that details, kind of like Mara was saying, that are going to serve the plot. So if you are talking about a particular person or a particular item over and over again, it better be important later. They're also looking for a mystery where they don't figure it out on page 46. They want to be going to the very last page to see either, you know, who did it or what happened, or even sometimes why the person who committed the crime committed it. So they want something that's going to grip them all the way to the very last page of the book. And they don't tend to like superfluous characters or items or subplots.
Okay, Mara, what do you think?
Well, I think it's a little different in my genre. In women's fiction, women, the readers like to feel that the author they're reading understands them and the complexities of their lives. Like Lisa and like me, they're juggling, they've got a whole bunch of plates spinning. Most of them are married. Most of them have children, maybe also have jobs, maybe also do nonprofit work, are engaged in all kinds of ways, and they would like to do a good job with each and every one of those endeavors. But what I find is that we women we don't even show up on our own to-do list. We put ourselves last. And so when I am speaking with book clubs and women's organizations, and I do, you know, quite a bit of speaking, we talk about that, and we laugh about it and say, yeah, I did, you know, the kids, the house, the husband, and everything else, and the pets. And then if I have time, I take a moment for myself. So we talk about what matters most to us and what is it that we always wanted to do. Are we doing it? And if not, why not? And if not now, when? And in a way, my characters are working out exactly those issues. Samantha, at her chapter in life, is ramping things up to say, well, I don't have totally unlimited time. If I'm going to have a breakthrough with these important issues to me, I better start right now. And Miranda, although she's younger, she too is saying, hey, what's the most important thing for me? That's what I want to be spending my time on. So.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Let's talk a little bit about setting. Now, Mara, you chose the Central Coast as your setting. But Lisa, you have chosen to create your own fictional setting. Let me ask you, Mara, why did you choose the Central Coast rather than make up a fictional setting?
I actually did both. The Central Coast chose me as much as I chose it. I just fell in love with the region and felt such a resonance of a sense of home that I knew I wanted to write about it. But I spent a summer performing in the real town of Cambria, California, and wanted to use that as a template. But I knew it would have to really be a fictional town because I didn't want to be constrained by I can only have a street go this way and I can only have a building over there. And I didn't want to offend people in town who by now had become friends, colleagues, readers. You know, so I created a fictional town, and I did quite a lot of research in choosing its location and its name. Cambria is the Roman name for Wales. The Welsh name is Cymru. And so Cambria in California was named for its physical resemblance to the western coast of Wales. So I looked at the map of Wales and found that there was a town for many hundreds of years called Milford Haven. So it would make sense there could easily be a Milford Haven, California, not far from the town of Cambria. And so I did a lot of research on history, geology, and many other elements. But because it is a fictional town, I have the freedom to create the characters and the spaces and the streets and the situations that I need to create. Although at one time in the actual town of Cambria, in the front of the bookstore, there was a huge sign that said, Milford Haven, is it Cambria?
Huh. Ooh. Ooh. Okay, Lisa, same with you. Same question for you. Now, you chose to do a fictionalized town in the Pennsylvania area, correct?
I did. And so I had written two books in a series before Josie Quinn that were set in Philadelphia because that's where I live. And the thing that I kept coming up against is that people who also live here would email me or message me and say, you know, you got this wrong. And I would say, no, I didn't. I drive past that every single day. I can actually take a picture of it this morning when I drive past it, and I know that I got it right. And it did, but it didn't matter. People were still sending me messages and saying, you know, so focused on whether it was accurate or not and not really paying attention to the story. So I felt like, in a sense, that was distracting. And on the other hand, by creating a fictional town, a lot like Mara said, you're not restricted by what is here or what is there or which way the street goes or, you know, is it possible to set this particular incident here at this place? So I used to work as a certified nurse assistant all over central Pennsylvania, north, south, east, and west. And I, you know, drove all over central Pennsylvania. I talked to people. I met people, people who had lived in these towns their whole lives. I lived there for a long time. And so what I did was take a lot of different elements from those towns and create my own fictional city, Denton. And I'm not restricted because it's all made up. But now I get emails, which I think are pretty funny, from readers saying, I live in Catawissa, which is an actual town, or Lewisburg, or Bloomsburg, or Berwick, or Hazleton, or Williamsport, all of which are real places. Is that the town that you're really writing about? And I say, no, it's just kind of a mishmash of all the different things that I've seen in central Pennsylvania and the places I visited and the people that I've had the privilege to talk to. So I find it's just a lot more fun. And like Mara said, it's not restrictive. And I don't get the, you know, so many of these spats over whether it was accurate or not in my messages or my emails anymore. So it's just a lot more fun for me to work in a fictional town.
Okay, thank you. So, Lisa, would you like to read a short excerpt from one of your books?
Sure. I'm going to read from the Josie Quinn detective series, book one. It's Vanishing Girls, and this is the prologue. There was a man in the woods. She was sure of it. For as long as she could remember, the woods had been her own special kingdom, teeming with plant and wildlife, the perfect setting for all the stories her imagination could conjure. A peaceful oasis away from her mother's hardened gaze and her father's disdain. She often felt him there, a presence, like a force field, pressing up against her little empire. As she moved through the forest, she heard him, a rustle of leaves, the snap of a branch. She'd seen bears and deer and foxes, even a bobcat once, in these woods. But the sounds he made were deliberate. They matched her own. She was sure it was a person, and judging by the heaviness of the steps, a man. Sometimes she heard his breath, heavy and labored. But whenever she turned to confront him, her heart pounding like a drumbeat in her chest, he was gone. Twice she had seen eyes peering through the thick foliage. Mama, she said one morning at breakfast, when she and her mother were alone. Her mother gave her a withering look. What? She asked. The words teetered on the tip of her tongue. There's a man in the woods. She stammered, unable to squeeze the words out. Her mother sighed and looked away. Eat your eggs. Her mother would not believe her anyway, but he was there. She was sure of it. It became a game. She told herself to stay at least 1 foot away from the edge of the trees at all times. But it only lured him in further, closer to the clearing behind her house, his body obscured by a tree trunk and branches covering the rest of his face. She couldn't breathe as she ran back to the house, imagining his hands brushing at her dress ties, reaching to yank her back. Only when her feet crossed the threshold of the back door did the air return to her lungs. For a week, she didn't come out of her room except to eat. After that, she only went outside if her mother, father, or sister were out there. For a long time, he disappeared. She stopped sensing him, stopped hearing him. She almost believed that he had gone back to wherever it was he came from. Maybe she had conjured him after all. Then one day, her sister was hanging clothes on the line while she flitted to the other side of the yard, chasing the yellow monarch butterflies that proliferated on top of the mountain. A white sheet fluttered on the clothesline, blocking her from her sister's view. She got too close to the tree line. A hand shot out and clamped down over her mouth, silencing her screams. An arm wrapped around her waist, lifting her off the ground. Holding her tightly against his chest, he dragged her through the forest that used to be her friend. One thought rose above her panic. He was real.
I know. That's fantastic. You know,
thank
I'm going to say to everybody out there who's read this book that I did this. After I finished the whole entire book, I went back and read the prologue again. And it just really makes, I don't know, I just think everybody should go back through and read that prologue again after they finish the whole book, because it really gives you a lot of more understanding of the prologue. Okay, And Mara, what about an excerpt from, which one are you gonna, which one do you want to read from?
I'm going to read from When the Heart Listens, which is just been out for a few days, and it's a prequel to the entire series, really about why Miranda ever moved to Milford Haven in the first place. So here's the excerpt. Miranda climbed the stairs to the kitchen, and when she saw a plastic-wrapped package of ramen on the counter and water just coming to a boil on the stove, knew her sister was home. Sure enough, Meredith came down from her bedroom wearing comfortable sweats and glasses pushed up on her head. "Hey, kiddo," she said, embracing her sister. "Hey, yourself." "Well, you seem different, like you let a lot of wind blow through your hair and air out your brain." Miranda laughed. "That about covers it." She paused. "Are you okay?" "Yep," Miranda said a little too forcefully. "Want soup?" Meredith asked. "Sounds good." The siblings got out placemats and chopsticks and settled at their wide kitchen island. "So," Meredith said, blowing across the steaming noodles she held aloft over her bowl, "tell me everything." "There's so much, Mare," Miranda said. "New opportunities, new perspectives, new, just new." Meredith put down her chopsticks, chewed on a crisp sesame cracker, and stared at her sister. "Oh, my God," she said a moment later. "You're leaving." Miranda smiled. "I am." After a pause, she continued, "It'll be better, right? I mean, you need your space. So do I. You can get another roommate, or maybe you don't even need to. You're doing so well at work. I mean, neither of us has had roommates since college, and we're both a little past it, right?" "Okay, confess," Meredith demanded. "Did you fall in love?" Miranda laughed again. "Yes, with a town." "What? You're not just moving, you're leaving the city?" Miranda paused. "I've loved being here with you," Meredith squinted. "Most of the time," Miranda amended. "I've loved our house, my co-op spot, lots of favorite places. It's taught me a lot, and I needed this step, needed to be close to you and within striking distance of the folks." "Did you miss them that much when you were in Vermont?" "Oh, I think I was too busy as a Bennington student to miss anyone much, except on those long winter nights." Miranda shivered at the memory of 50 below wind chill and howling winds, hardly something any California girl took in stride. "Bennington was perfect for me," Miranda continued. "The whole mental atmosphere of artistic exploration, personal best challenges, finding your own voice, just what I needed. And we did have work terms, giving us some real-world internships, but being there was also living a sheltered, nurtured life of privilege. So hurling myself into the art world of a major city like San Francisco was daunting. Being close to mother and dad and to you also gave me the certainty that people who cared were near." She looked into her sister's eyes. "You made this huge, intimidating city feel safe and as comfortable as I can be in a city." "Oh, Mandy," Meredith said, reaching across the counter to touch her hand. "And now I'm connecting with my own, I don't know if roots is really the right word, but my soul sings by the water and the mountains where the color is green and sometimes yellow." "You painted that, didn't you, before you went on your trip?" "I did. It felt like a sign." "So, okay, forgive me for being practical for a moment, but did you get a job? Do you have enough money for the move? Did you find a place to live?" Miranda took a breath. "I did get a good commission, enough to get me launched, and I can stay at someone's guest house for a month while I look for my own place. It's all going to work out," Miranda reassured her sister. Meredith said, "Sounds like you're the one who's already worked it out." After a pause, she asked, "Told Mother and Dad yet?" "No. Mother will be concerned, I know. Dad won't mind. And that artist rep you have? Oh, Zelda will have a cow." The two of them sat in their kitchen laughing until Miranda realized she was also crying.
Wow. Thank you. I haven't read that one yet, Mar. I'm gonna have to is it out as an ebook now too?
It is not. It's only available pre-order in print. But I'll tell you a secret. I'm doing an event near you in Arroyo Grande on Saturday, so you can get one in person. I'm doing just a few for my Central Coast followers to begin with.
Okay, now where are you going to be on Saturday?
Starbucks, Arroyo Grande. I'll send you an email.
Okay, please do. Yeah, please do. Okay, ladies, I want to, before we run out of time here, Lisa, let's go back to you. How about some advice for someone out there who's maybe thinking they want to write or maybe wondering why they're trying to write? How about some advice?
The advice that I always give other writers or aspiring writers is just to write as much as you can. Even if you're not writing what you want to write yet, I really believe that the act of getting the words from your brain onto the page in any form is going to serve you. So even if you have this grand story in your mind that you want to write and you're just not there yet, then write other things, journal or do essays or write emails or write to your congressperson or write about what you would like to write about. But you need to get your mind and your body used to doing that act, to getting the words from your brain and onto the page. So I always say to aspiring writers, write, 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 and then when you finally get to the point where you've got a story, then you have to find critique partners or beta readers to help you make that better, but people who are not going to tell you that it's wonderful all the time. So nobody that has an emotional stake in your work, just people who are going to be honest with you.
Okay, thank you. Fantastic advice. Mara, how about you?
I second everything Lisa just said. I think just writing is the most important thing to begin with, even if it's letters, journals, anything at all. And I guess I do work with other authors and love mentoring other authors. And I firmly believe if you have it in your heart to write, that you must not run away from it, suppress it, or assume that it's silly. It's something. It's something that is calling to you, and there's a reason for it, all of which will become clear farther down the path after you've started to engage with that process. That process may lead you into something else entirely. It may just be a transitional piece for you, a bridge to something you hadn't imagined, or it may become an end unto itself. But listen to that guidance, listen to that intuition, because I really believe it's telling you something valid that you should do.
Okay, thank you. So, Mara, before we run out of time, tell me what you're working on now.
I'm working on the first paranormal story in my series. I have a really interesting journalist character. She is based to some extent on my own years as a journalist, and but she has had adventures that I didn't have. She finds her way to the Central Coast, but she became thematically the representation of the head, where Miranda became the representation of the heart. So where Miranda is responding to this impulse to completely shift her life, Chris is really stubbornly sticking with it has to be logic, it has to make sense. And she does so really to her peril and has gotten into trouble early on in my series. I have a mystery that weaves its way through my entire series rather than concluding a case with each book. So I can't really call this a mystery series in any traditional way, but there is a core mystery in the Milford Haven novels. And Chris is an important part of that. She starts that mystery in the prologue of book one. And so now we're going to pick up her story, and it's called What the Soul Suspects.
I love paranormal, so I'm looking forward to that. Okay, Lisa, what are you working on now?
I'm just about to start book eight in Josie Quinn, which is going to feature heavily her sister and also a serial killer. But right now, December 2nd, book seven of the series will come out in paperback, audio, and ebook, and it's available for pre-order in ebook form right now. It's called Cold Heart Creek. And Josie is called to a scene deep in the woods where a couple is dead, and we're not really sure if it was murder-suicide or something that they ingested or if someone murdered them. So that case is going to take her down some pretty unexpected roads.
Wow, okay. I'm way behind. It's going to take a while before for me to get to book seven. Okay, so before we run out of time, Lisa, tell everyone where they can find your books and where they can find out more about you.
My books, probably the best place would be Amazon or Barnes & Noble. And then you can find out anything you want to know about my books or myself at my website, which is www.lisaregan.com. It's LISAREGAN.com.
Okay, thank you. And Maura, same question.
The most centralized information is all on my website, MauraPearl.com, and Pearl is P-U-R-L. And from there, there are buy links for all the books in my series at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the major booksellers. Most of the books are, except for the brand new ones, are available in hardcover, softcover, ebook, and audio.
Okay, thank you. I want to thank you, ladies, for being my guest. I think this is one of the more enjoyable talks and shows that I've did. So thank you very much. I look forward to Maura. I'm going to hopefully see you on Saturday so I can get a copy of this new book you're talking about. And Lisa, I've only read the first book, so I've got a lot of catching up to do with Josie. So that's going to be happening real soon. So again, thank you, and please let your fans know that this will be archived within a couple hours, and if they couldn't hear the show live, they can go to the link that I sent you, and they can listen to the show.
Great.
Lisa, it was so lovely to meet you virtually. I'm looking forward to reading your books, and I hope you come to the West Coast sometime. Maybe we can do an event together.
Well, that would be lovely.
And Barbara, thank you so much for having us. What a great show.
Yes, thank you, Maura. And I'm sure I'll be seeing you around sooner or later, hopefully this Saturday.
Yes. Wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks, ladies. Have a good evening now.
You too.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.